Welcome to Coaching Uncaged, the podcast that pushes the boundaries of the coaching profession with cutting-edge practitioners, authors, and thought leaders. Coaching Uncaged brings you pioneering thinking to enrich the art and science of coaching in all its forms. And now, introducing your host, Robert Stevenson.
Hello and welcome to the podcast. Today, I'm super excited to be speaking with Claire Norman. Claire is a coach, a mentor, a supervisor, and an author. In fact, she's the author of Mentor Coaching, A Practical Guide. So today, we're going to be talking all things mentor coaching and what sits in and around that. It's great to have you in the conversation, Claire.
And it's good to be here, Robert. Thank you for inviting me.
So you're the author of Mentor Coaching, A Practical Guide. So I guess what I'd like to maybe start with is what led you to write the book?
So it's the first book of it about mental coaching in the English language. I did discover after I published that there is one in Spanish, but it's the first English language book about mental coaching, and I do like to fill gaps. So this is my attempt to fill a gap that I saw, because so many people seemed confused about what is mental coaching and how is it similar or different to supervision. Even though it is something that is necessary for International Coaching Federation credentialing, even people in the ICF don't always know what is mental coaching compared to supervision and how do I make the most of it. And then, you know, more broadly than that, I also wanted to open it up to coaches who are aligned with other coaching bodies who don't have a requirement for mental coaching as part of their credentialing path, but we can all make the most of it. It's something that really takes us to our edge time and time again to get feedback on our coaching so that we can improve.
And you say there about, you know, the ICF being confused. I remember a few years ago, if I remember rightly, that it felt like they were the same things. It felt like when you were, you know, getting your credentials or recredentialing, it was about just having supervision around your coaching. And now there's much more clear guidelines around what they're really looking for.
Yes, exactly. And yes, you're right. Until, I don't know, what was it, maybe 6 years ago, 7 years ago, you were able to use supervision as your getting ready for credentialing for the ICF. But now they have got much clearer and they've said, no, actually it's mental coaching we want you to have, because that sets you up for success for submitting your recordings of your coaching to the ICF. It gets you ready to submit a really great recording that is representative of you at your best. So rather than that being, you know, two separate things, actually now they've made that kind of part and parcel of getting you ready to submit your best recording. But I also think that we should separate it out from the credentialing process and look at it as something we do. You know, we come back to mentor coaching once a year, three times a year, in order to get or resharpen our edge, because we get dull so quickly, we take shortcuts so quickly. And so to have somebody observe us and give us feedback on our coaching is just invaluable.
So with that, if you could maybe tell us a little bit more about the process of mentor coaching, because I think that some of our listeners will have an idea or a sense of what that is. It'd be great to get your perspective on that.
Yeah. So it's observed coaching with feedback. And for the purposes of ICF credentialing, that's feedback using the ICF competencies. Of course, if you're aligned to a different coaching body, you might use your own competencies. But it could be that you bring a recording to your mentor coach for you both to listen to together, and you stop and start the recording and you think about how am I showing up and what am I saying or doing that's getting in the way of my thinker's thinking? What am I doing that's actually challenging and supporting them well? So we're looking for strengths and stretches in mental coaching in the recording. It could be that we do it live, in which case you would do that as a group of coaches all together, and they would take it in turns to coach somebody else in the room with everybody else watching and the mental coach. And then you have a feedback process at the end where the coach gives themselves feedback, followed by the thinker, followed by all the observers, and then last but not least, the mental coach. But what you get, what you see from that is that it is all about observed coaching with feedback against a benchmark set of competencies. So not just, I like the way you, or, oh, I loved how you, but I noticed how you said X, and that was a demonstration of Y competency. So it's really data driven as well.
Because I think, especially as new coaches in that observation feel, because I know that, you know, at Animus, in our training, there is lots of observed coaching taking place. But I also recognize that sometimes in that observed coaching, we can get nice in that, and we can want to be supportive. And it's great to be supportive, and there's a place for that. But it doesn't sharpen that edge when people are going, I like that, as opposed to, I noticed you did that and I thought it was useful because it relates to.
Yes.
Or it created this in the space. So really being clear about what is it we're looking at, what is it that we're seeing, as opposed to what is it we like. Because we can like somebody's style, but it can be not very useful, in inverted commas, to a coachee. And I noticed also that you talk about the thinkers as opposed to the coachee or the client. And just that sort of caught my attention.
Yeah, so I call them the thinker because that is what they do. They think that, you know, I'm trying to help them to understand that they're the one who needs to do the heavy lifting here. They get to do all the thinking. It's not me doing the thinking for them. So it is a partnership, of course, that the coach is responsible for the process and creating the safe space to do that great thinking, creating a container within which brilliant thinking can happen. But it's the thinker who is responsible for doing the thinking. Yeah.
Absolutely. I always think that's useful to hear. I mean, you've placed it in a slightly different way to how others have placed it, but the idea that how do we enable our thinkers or our coachees to recognize that they're there to do the work, as opposed to us doing the work. Because sometimes we can get caught in the, I want to make this work, I want to make this right, and we do the heavy lifting in the session, as opposed to going, okay, it's you that's doing the work here. I'm doing work too, because it's a collaboration and all of that, but not to get caught up in the, let me make this happen as the coach.
Yeah, and there's something for me about a shift in mindset for the coach, moving away from being a service provider who needs to add value to being a partner with the thinker. So the two of them are creating value together. It's not me there in service of, it's me in partnership with. And I think that mindset shift makes a big difference to how the two of us show up.
Yeah, I really like that, you know, in partnership with creating value together. Because I think sometimes we do get caught in the how can I add value?
Yeah.
And what's really interesting is when we're adding value, sometimes we're moving away from coaching.
Yes.
And so by getting mentor coaching, where we really look at what it is that we're doing, we can get back to the craft of coaching.
Yeah, and what I notice when I'm observing coaches is how much coaches are driven by voices in their heads that come from previous roles. So, for example, as a worker, they have learnt to solve problems, to fix things. And that is really hard to shake. And we know as coaches, you know, when we're coaches in training, we know how hard that is to stop ourselves from offering the fix or asking a leading question that is taking the thinker towards a fix, a right answer in inverted commas. And we need to unlearn that kind of stuff. And it's not until we put ourselves under the spotlight and have a more experienced coach observing us that we realize, oh, I didn't even know I was doing that. I mean, we can listen to our own recordings and hopefully pick that up ourselves, but sometimes we are oblivious to it. We don't even know when we listen to our own recordings, gosh, I was rescuing at that point, or I was so driven to add value that I did X rather than, you know, the less is more kind of a approach of allowing them to solve their own stuff.
And I think sometimes when we listen to our own sessions, we confuse style within that as well. So we go, well, that's my style. And it almost becomes an excuse for doing stuff that isn't quite coaching. And, you know, I'm a great believer in mixing and integrating the way in which we work. But I also think we need to be really clear about what is it that we are mixing. It's like we need to know the different ingredients in their totality before we mix them. So if we mix it too early, we can't then untangle it. We get caught up in it and we go, oh yeah, that's just my style. That's the way that I do it. That's the way I show up. And it's like, that's great. But is that really a partnership that has coaching as its bedrock, or is that something else? And if it's something else, great. But then we need to title it that something else.
Yeah, I'm with you on that. And what I notice when people come to my mentor coaching programs is they say, I don't want to become a cookie cutter. I don't want to be like every other coach. Well, and the reason they say that is because they see the list of competencies and they think that's going to make them a cookie cutter. Well, no, because you still can bring your style into it. You still do bring everything from your past into this coaching conversation, but there are also things that you need to unlearn from your history that are not coaching. And yes, they might have been your style in the past, but as you say, maybe they were a consultancy style or a mentoring style, not a coaching style. So we can still be ourselves as coaches, living those competencies and not being a cookie cutter, but being a great coach in that.
You know, I love that phrase, the unlearning, and it sort of makes me go, there's often unlearning that we need to do that we're not even aware of that exists in you know, how we show up and how easy it can be to wrap up what we need to unlearn and go, well, no, I don't need to unlearn that because that's my way of being. Or that's me as a human being. And it's like, that's all wonderful and great, but what's really coaching there and what's not? And as you were saying about, we can still be our own self and have our own style within that, those competencies. Recently, myself going through reapplication for my own credential, and going through that mentor coaching process with a group, kind of going, oh, everybody shows up really differently. We're all really working to these competencies. And our mentor coach is really holding us accountable to this. But every single person shows up differently and in a different way. And I remember at the beginning being really frustrated with the feedback that I was getting around my coaching, and then kind of going, well, actually, that's really useful, because that's what I call style or way of being, or that's, you know, that's how I coach. But some of the time, actually, it's not really useful in the coaching process itself. It's maybe more useful to me, or more useful to keeping it sometimes nice and okay, as opposed to challenging and deep.
And that word useful is really important. So we are there to be useful to and with the thinker. And what is going to be most useful to their new thinking? So all the time I'm looking for ways that coaches show up that enables their thinker to have new thinking, not go over old ground, old thinking. So, you know, quite often thinkers show up in coaching thinking it's just like any other conversation, and they fill us in on all the detail and all the story. We don't need to hear all of that in order to be a great coach for them. Now, it might be useful to them to say it out loud, but we don't know that unless we check. So our role as coaches is actually to interrupt that story and enable them to make a conscious decision about whether they say that stuff out loud, rather than thinking, well, I need to tell you all of this to make sure you know the whole story. Well, we don't.
And often when we get that story, we become caught up in that story, and we start to collude with that story's existence as opposed to challenging the story. And I think sometimes our clients, our coaches, our thinkers know that and bring that to the space so as to either consciously or unconsciously, but in order to avoid the heavy lifting that might need to take place.
Yeah, I think that's true. I'm not sure that they mostly do it consciously, but I do think there are some avoidance tactics going on some of the time to fill the space so that they don't need to tackle the thing that really counts, the thing that's really important to them, or, you know, the most meaningful way that they could spend the time. So as coaches, you know, the other thing that I'll challenge coaches to do more of is, as well as the interrupting, the storytelling, but also to recontract, ask the thinker, how useful is this? Or what do you know now that you didn't know at the beginning? And now where are we going? So that the thinker is always making conscious decisions about how they use that time that you have together. They're not inadvertently wasting time.
I remember when I used to be part of the training team, and I used to talk about how that contract and recontracting is like moving the aeroplane's homing beacon. It's like we need to know where we're heading. We put that beacon down and we head in that direction. And then when we're not sure, we're still going there. Let's check, because do we need to move the beacon somewhere else to head into a new direction? And how being really clear around that contract allows us to really be clear about, so what's my job here as the thinking generator, as it were, within this relationship?
Yeah, and I notice so few coaches, when they come to mentor coaching, they don't recontract very much. They don't put a stake in the ground as to, you know, where are we now and where do we need to go next? And that's something that they can definitely learn through mentor coaching, how they're showing up, how they're missing that quality of placing the beacon. I love that analogy. That's great. I'm going to use that one. So some of the things I notice in mentor coaching are omissions, so things they could add in that would make their coaching much better. And then some of the things that I notice are, I was going to say bad habits, but they don't even know that they're bad habits. They're things that have come from childhood or school or work. You know, assumptions that they've got about this is the way we have conversation. And those are the things they need to unlearn rather than adding in.
And I think those assumptions can be so ingrained as in us that we don't even notice that they're assumptions until somebody listens to us in conversation and goes, what's that? What are you doing? When you say that, what's going on there? What are you bringing? What are you assuming in the conversation? And what are you not challenging in those moments?
So, for example, and I hope you don't teach this at Animas, but some coach training companies teach their aspiring coaches to say, tell me more about that. Now, tell me more about that invites more story. It invites more of the stuff they already know. It invites them to fill me in. And the whole point is they need to be filling themselves in, not me. Yeah. The idea is to evoke awareness in them, not in me.
Yeah.
So there's, I mean, that's such a simple phrase. And yet when you look at it, you're like, oh gosh, that's so obvious. Now that you say that, I should not be saying, tell me more about that. There should be a question like, so what's important to you about that? Or what's the meaning behind that? Or what does that word mean for you? Or whatever.
Yeah, so, you know, at Animus, we're really into that, staying curious and tell me more about, might be some of the phrasing, but the intention is, so what are you learning here? What are you understanding here? What are you taking from this? And it might be, is there more to say here around this? And, you know, I'm, over the years of coaching and working in this industry, you get so caught up in language, and language is so important, and phrases that we kind of just throw away have meaning wrapped up within them that we don't even notice. And I'm often reminded, or reminded myself, that it's, you know, what we're saying is so important, and as coaches, our questions are really important, and to take the time to think about that question and not just to rush in, especially as new coaches, we're firing questions all the time, and we think that that's part of the value, is that we've got this stack of questions ready, when actually pondering, what is it that I'm thinking here, or that I want to invite into the space? And so what's the best use of language to bring that into the space? It's one of the things that I really like about sort of clean coaching and clean language, is kind of stripping away all of my stuff and really pulling what's the client talking about here. And, you know, I remember when I came across Caitlin Walker's work around clean language, and just kind of going, oh, I love this idea that I'm stepping out of this, and I'm using language that allows you to step into this space as opposed to my language living in the space.
You know, one of the things that I noticed yesterday when I was mentor coaching somebody was that she had inserted her own language into a question when the thinker had used their own perfectly good language to represent whatever it was. And so why does the coach feel that they need to embellish or use a different word? It's almost as though the coach is trying to prove something. I'm not sure what they're trying to prove, but it gets in the way, because all of a sudden the thinker has to do this translation of, very quick translation, sure, but from how did they get from my word to that word? And so that gets in their way of doing their best thinking, because they're needing to make this translation, or wondering, did I not use the right word? Because we don't want them to doubt their own language.
And I think that's one of the keys there, is that when we insert our own language as opposed to using the client language, it can give this indication that the client's language is incorrect.
Yeah.
And then they start to model their language on our language. And I'm like, the client's language is rich with meaning for them.
Yes.
And to negate that is to almost discard them as being a partner in this work. Or, you know, especially when we talk about it's client led, it's about where the client wants to go, what the client wants to do. Mm. If we start imposing our own language in there, unless that language is interrupter language, unless that language is to challenge language. But when we just go, they use that word, I'm going to put my own version in there, and without thinking about it, that's when the challenge really kicks in.
And that's the kind of thing that we don't notice for ourselves as coaches. We don't realize we've just done that until we listen back to the recording, and or, I mean, even then it gets missed, but listening to it with somebody else who can see, oh, I noticed they use this word, you use this word. What was going on for you there? Mm. And what was the impact that may have had on your thinking?
Because in supervision, that stuff just isn't picked up, because we're bringing what's going on for us to supervision.
Yes, so it's self-reported. Supervision is, here's what happened a week ago, and here's my memory of what happened. And of course, my memory of it could be very different from the thinker's memory. We could we could be missing all sorts of stuff when we take something to supervision. Now, I'm not saying supervision is a bad thing at all, because I'm a supervisor as well. So it's absolutely a valuable tool. But what I think is that we should be investing in both supervision and mental coaching side by side, because they offer us something different. Yeah. Supervision can enable us to tap into the best coach we can be in terms of how we're feeling, our confidence levels, etc. And mental coaching is all about how we show up, you know, with the language and the kind of start to finish, the arc of the session, making sure we've got the contract in place, a good close, all of that stuff. That shows up in mental coaching, and it doesn't show up in supervision.
Yeah, I you know, having recently gone through mental coaching myself, I really found it valuable. I have to be honest and say I found it challenging, because there's a real spotlight placed on your work, and there's a real, you know, there's good mentor coaching and bad mentor coaching, because as the coach, there's a real vulnerability that you place yourself into when you go through that, and you begin to, well, not everybody, but you can begin to question your own work and your own value. And if you're not careful, you can get caught up in a loop of, well, I'm not very good, and that was bad, and that can be in conjunction with the language that the mentor coach uses with you in terms of looking at what you're doing. But when I was going through the process, I was like, there's something really useful here, because I can take this learning about the, you know, how is my coaching showing up in relationship to competencies. And I can also go to my supervisor and explore how am I showing up in relationship to my clients and what's being triggered for me, and where is my safe space, and where do I need to move a client into a different, not move physically, but how do I have to have conversations with the client about perhaps a different space or a different way of working, depending on what's coming up from their sessions. And it's like, as you're saying, there are these two parts that enable us to be at our best. And when I think about athletes, I think it's what an athlete will do is, you know, they'll have somebody that just talks to them about technique. Yeah. And then they'll have somebody that talks to them about their mindset or their emotions. And it's like, they don't have a single, they have multiple people that work with them to enable them to be the best athlete they can be. Likewise, as coaches, we need multiple people working with us to hone us to be the best coach that we can be.
Yeah, and we need those people with us along our whole journey. So it's not just when we're a beginner coach. And I think that's a trap that people fall into. Oh, I've got my credential now, I don't need to have mental coaching again. But it's just like taking your driving test. You know, you are at peak performance when you take that driving test. At the end of your coach training, you are at peak performance. Or when you go for your credential, you're at peak performance. Why would you let it slip? Why would you, like you're driving, end up taking shortcuts or not even knowing how you get from point A to point B? I mean, of course, that means we weren't fully present when we were driving, which is very dangerous. Don't do this at home. But it, you know, the same is the case in coaching. If we're not present, if we don't know how we got from point A to point B and are not present, then we are not doing a great job as coach. And so we need to keep bringing ourselves back to mental coaching, back to supervision over the course of our lifetime, no matter how experienced we are as a coach. They are absolutely crucial to keeping ourselves sharp.
And it's a bit like, if we carry on with that, the driving metaphor, it's the MOT. It's like having those regular MOTs that allow us to go, yep, this is all running well. Yeah, oh, no, I need to change that part out.
Yeah. Change that oil or change that. Yeah.
And I think it also allows us to go, oh, I'm no longer, coaching is no longer my thing. It's not what I do. I have moved into something else. I think there's something there as well. So we can really recognize, well, what is the work that I'm currently doing?
Yes. Yeah. And And making conscious decisions about, yeah, is it still coaching that I want to be doing? If it is, I need to bring myself back to coaching and not whatever else I've
because I know that in my kind of experience, I meet clients who tell me that they've had a coach, and I say, you know, share with me a bit about your experience and what that was like. And they start talking to me about that, and I'm going, that doesn't sound like coaching to me. And it's like, you know, sometimes it's because that person hasn't trained as a coach or has had poor training, but sometimes it's because they're no longer coaching, but they haven't actually identified that that's no longer what they're doing.
Yeah, and then we have thinkers showing up expecting that thing, and that's not what we offer. So we have to have a really good recontracting conversation before we've even started about actually, here's what I'm offering, and if that's what you are signing up for, great, we'll go for it. But if you want something different, I'm not the person.
Yeah. There was something you said earlier about the interrupting the story or checking in on the story, and it kind of caught my attention, because I'm a lover of narrative coaching and a lover of storytelling. In my past life, storytelling was part of what I did, and I'm always aware of how I see there is a richness in the story that is presented to us. And I guess I just wanted to explore with you, when we're thinking about interrupting that story, what is it you mean by that, as opposed to what I might be taking away from interrupting a story when I see a story as being useful?
Yeah, great question. So if it's a story that they've only ever held inside their heads, then I think it's really useful for them to say it out loud. Because in the saying it out loud, they get new insights that they've never had before. If, on the other hand, it's a story that they told their mate at the pub, you know, over a glass of wine or a pint of beer, then they know that stuff already. It's a story that's well told. It's well trodden. And by saying it out loud again, they're not necessarily going to get new thinking. So I'm all about new thinking. So the interruption would not be to tell them to stop telling their story, but more to invite them to be conscious about whether they choose to say it out loud because it is useful to them, or whether actually, no, I know this already, so it's not useful to me to say it out loud. So the interruption would be, can I just check whether this is useful for you to say this out loud? Don't feel you need to fill me in on all the detail. So it's more that, making it a conscious choice for them about whether it's useful. And some people say, no, you're right, I do know all of this. And some people say, actually, no, I just need to get my thoughts together, and I can only do that by saying it out loud. Yeah. And that's, you know, that's their choice. But at least we've made it a conscious choice, rather than eating into 20 minutes of a session and then realizing, when we ask the question, so what do you know now that you didn't know at the beginning? And they say, oh, I don't know anything new. So we've just used that 20 minutes to not get any new thinking. That's a long chunk of a coaching session to not get new thinking from.
And I think as you were saying that, I was also holding on to this thought that when we're listening to that story, we're also listening to what's new and what's different, and what have they not recognized that they are presenting in that story, so we can reflect that to them so that there is learning gained. And so there's something also about, you know, how are we listening to the story? So we're not just a passive receiver, like we're watching telly and they're just kind of sharing this stuff, but we're looking into this and going, what's happening here? What's going on? What's this about? What can I question? What's being, so one of the things for me is, you know, what's being left out? When you're telling me this, what are you leaving out? What's not present? What can I feel that's existing but isn't being named in the space?
And we might not know what it is, but we get a hunch that something is being left out. And so, yeah, we're not trying to fill gaps there, but more ask them the question of, what are you missing out in this story? Or what are you learning about yourself as you tell this story? Or what's new in this story for you? Or what are you who are you showing up as? And it's those kinds of questions that get to a depth of learning and new thinking versus the old story.
And that who are you really plays into my wheelhouse as I love to explore who are you showing up as in your story? And what's that about? What's that role that you are playing? Is it one that's been placed upon you? Is it one that you've chosen? And is it what you want? Are you being who you want to be? And that I recognize that kind of sits into that sort of the acting and the narrative stuff of me. But I'm really curious about, so how are we showing up in the world? And how do we want to show up? And is that showing up forced upon us? You know, a bit like what you were saying, that unlearning, you know, have we just learned to be this person in the world, so we're showing up like that? And to how can, as coaches, can we ask the questions that help to uncover how we're showing up, what we're showing up as, and to get conscious of that?
What you're reminding me of there is you know, in work we're taught to bring solutions, not questions. And so sometimes coaches show up in that mindset of, I need to have solutions, not questions. I mean, they come with questions as well, but they're driving to a solution. And actually the real, you can see I can't quite grasp it. I'm rubbing my fingers together. The texture, the beauty, the nuggets of diamonds are, or nuggets of gold, it should be, shouldn't it, really? They come from this exploration of who the person is and how they show up. And that exploration, so one of the things I notice a lot of coaches do is as soon as they finish the contracting for the session, they might ask a question that's a very action-orientated question, like, so what are you going to do? But that should come at the end of a session, not at the beginning. And again, it's something that they don't realize that they're doing. They're going straight to solution rather than helping the individual to understand what's beneath this. What's going on for you here? What do you want from this? How do you want to be? All of that beautiful exploration stuff that needs to happen in the middle before the epiphanies. I mean, the epiphanies will come without an action-orientated question, frankly. But equally, if we're putting pressure on ourselves as coaches to create epiphanies or aha moments, then we need to stop doing that as well, because they don't come in every session necessarily. But sometimes it's the little things that people learn about themselves that make the biggest difference.
I remember speaking with David Drake, and he was saying, you know, he's not interested in those aha moments. And there's something, when we strive for that, we stop coaching and we start proving how great we are at getting somebody to shift. And then it all becomes about us.
Yes, it does.
And it's like, how do we step away from that and do the craft, do the work that then allows that to emerge? It sort of reminds me of that sort of the Gestalt way of working. It's like we're creating a space or a vacuum, even, where something emerges into it, as opposed to placing something into it.
Yes, I'm with you. So again, this thing that we need to unlearn as coaches is this need to add value by creating an aha moment, or add value by inserting something in that's our own stuff and not theirs. Or, you know, there's all sorts of ways that we get caught up in adding value because that's what's been expected of us in our work lives, for example, or in our school lives, where more is more, when actually in coaching, less is more.
And I think there's something here as well where that's part of the, I guess, the marketing of ourselves as coaches that kicks in. And I know we're talking about mentor coaching, but it just kind of occurred to me that part of this adding value and these aha moments is perhaps part of our desire to show how great we are so that more clients will pay for our service and therefore we can make a living. So we're caught in this loop of I've got to do this so people talk about me in this way so I can then present, you know, this value that I create for my clients so that they'll exchange money for it. And it's almost like we need to separate that adding value from a marketing perspective from the coaching session itself.
Yes, yeah. Because actually I think we will be adding way more value by not trying to add value. And we will still get amazing results, amazing testimonials, if we just step back from trying to create the aha moment or trying to... I know I'm guilty of this, but if somebody cries in a session, I think, great, we've tapped into a nerve, and I do this little internal dance. I'm sorry to my thinkers who have cried in my sessions. But I suspect that's a thing that many coaches feel, that's goodness. I mean, it is goodness. It is, because we are tapping into something raw, something meaningful to them. But that's not what we should be striving for. We shouldn't be striving to make them cry, or striving for that aha moment, or striving for the, whatever that is.
And I think when, you know, this really interesting, that language about striving, it reminds me of mindfulness and that idea about non-striving. And then the simplicity of the work. So if we keep the work simple, we keep the work pure, then these things will emerge, as opposed to trying to make them emerge. And I guess if we go all the way back to mentor coaching, that's part of what that's doing. It's going, well, let's keep the simplicity of this craft at play to enable the aha or the emotional tapping into to come in to that space by doing the craft.
Yes. Yeah. Trust the process. That's all there is to it, really. Trust the process. Trust myself as the coach, trust them, trust that they can do great thinking, and that they are resourceful, creative and whole. So it's trusting in every part of that system that something will emerge that is really useful and really valuable to them. It will emerge if we hold that space, if we create the psychological safety, hold that space for them to do their best thinking, stay out of their way, and just see what emerges.
I feel that's such a beautiful sentiment. I kind of feel like we should leave the listeners with that moment ringing through their ears. So yeah, I feel like we've kind of landed in a really useful and interesting space around trusting the self, the client, the process, the space. It's been fascinating speaking with you, Claire. I'm aware that we could talk for hours about this.
So yeah.
I'd love to invite you back for us to talk some more about this. And if people want to find you, get hold of you, connect you, where might they do that?
Well, first things first, if they want to read the book, Mental Coaching, A Practical Guide, they can find that on Amazon and other good booksellers. And they'll learn more about mental coaching, how to make the most of it for themselves. But also, if they want to become a mental coach, there's information there. And I run a training program for aspiring mental coaches too. But they can get a hold of me at claire@clairenormancoachingassociates.com. Claire is without an I, so C-L-A-R-E, claire@clairenormancoachingassociates.com. And it would be lovely to hear from people with any questions they've got about mental coaching or supervision or any of this other stuff we've talked about coaching today and what they need to unlearn.
Brilliant. And I feel like it might be really useful for us to have one of these conversations in a live space with the community, so they can ask those questions and get involved in that way. So maybe there's something we can cook up down the road.
Lovely. Yeah, I'd be well up for that.
Brilliant. Thank you so much for joining with me today, Claire.
Thank you, Robert.
If you'd like to watch these episodes as well as listen, you can find the video interviews on our YouTube channel and website now. Thanks for tuning in to Coaching Uncaged. Join us again for more captivating conversations, exploring the art of coaching.